Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As we go to air, the House is set to begin last-ditch deliberations on the so-called fiscal cliff following the convening of the Senate 1 hour ago. Keith Poole, the chair of political science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at UC San Diego, joins us. He is the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Equal Rights, and Ideology and Congress. We will discuss the role of ideology and money in the latest standoff between a president who promised to make the rich pay their fair share of taxes and the Republicans who are determined to protect tax cuts for the top 1%. Then we will speak with a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, William Vizard, about how the NRA protects criminals while claiming to protect the rights of law-abiding citizens. We will discuss how Congress, at the behest of the NRA, have passed laws that make it impossible for law enforcement to share data on guns used in crimes, who sells them, buys them, and uses them in committing murders and armed robberies. Then finally, we'll go to Amman, Jordan, and speak with Dawood Katoub, who is a leading Palestinian journalist who is at the forefront of revealing what could be an historical shift in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute over land and sovereignty that has been deadlocked for over 40 years. We'll discuss the secret negotiations going on between the Israelis and the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan that could lead to a breakthrough deal, first reported by Dawood Katoub's article in The Atlantic, "Are Palestinians Ready to Share a State with Jordan?" Joining us now is Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science and the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Yep, glad to be here.
And the Senate is convened an hour ago, and the House is just convening as we go to air. So do you expect anything to happen here? I mean, this is last-minute brinksmanship over a sort of an apocalyptic idea of a fiscal cliff that is somewhat imaginary, but it seems to have captured the attention of the press, and they've gone along with this notion that the ship of state's about to fall off the cliff. What's your sense of whether anything serious will be accomplished in the next few hours?
I don't think they will pass a bill today. Probably, if the Senate does pass something, it'll be late tonight. And if the Senate does pass something, it will be taken up in the House tomorrow. I have not seen whether or not they've actually made a deal yet. And even if they have made a deal, it'll be fairly small and not deal with the spending cuts and most of the other tax issues besides just the marginal rates probably and the AMT. And probably they will probably extend the unemployment, but that's not clear.
So when Senator Lindsey Graham says that the president won, what's he saying here? It doesn't look like anybody's won here, particularly the American people.
The election was essentially a standoff with slight edge to the Democrats. But then again, the Republicans in the House, after being fairly heavily criticized for 2 years, only lost 8 seats. Republicans fielded very, very bad senatorial candidates and ended up losing seats rather than gaining seats. And President Obama won, even though he got roughly about 5 million fewer votes than he did in 2008. So the public is just generally unhappy, and the public is conflicted. It's the old problem of they want their cake and they want to eat their cake as well. So they don't want to. It's fine to raise taxes, but as long as you don't raise my taxes and don't cut my benefits, cut somebody else's benefits. So politicians basically their main interest in life is being reelected. So they will keep repeating the same old stories to people as long as they keep getting elected. So we're in a real fix because the public opinion is inconsistent, and so it's no surprise that these people can't deal with the underlying problems.
Well, Keith Poole, it seems that the standoff, it seems to me, well, let me put it this way. It seems that the idea that this is about ideologies is very questionable because it also, I think, is about political patronage. I can't understand any other reason why the Republicans are going to the mat for the wealthiest 1%. They did it before with the debt ceiling crisis, which has led to the sequester, led to this so-called fiscal cliff. And that's the line that they've drawn. And they humiliated their own speaker the other day, who tried to come up with a compromise because they didn't want to raise taxes on the wealthy. And on the other side, you've got a president who ran his I think his main campaign theme was that the rich have to pay their fair share of taxes. So isn't that what this is essentially about?
Yeah, but it's basically a cartoon issue because it's an ideological cartoon because the amount of money we're talking about here is just is so small given the size of our problems that this is all symbolic. The president campaigned on raising taxes on people above $250,000, and the Republicans have not gone along with a tax increase since the Bush tax increases in 1990. And so they're determined that sort of, basically a scorched earth standoff. My hunch is, though, that if McConnell and Reid get a deal where the top rate is $400,000 and above, then I think you'll get a majority of Republicans in the House will go along with that. And with the Democrats, that'll be enough to pass it in the House.
So that would mean actually less revenues again, right?
It would be the same exact tax code now, only there would be a tax increase on I believe, these things are always slippery. I think it's family, it's household income of 400 grand and above. And so you get that additional revenue, but it's really not very much, given the scale of the entitlement problem we have. So, yeah, it's very, very, very small potatoes.
Again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who is a distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Rights, Ideology and Congress, and Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. And we're talking about this latest brinksmanship as the new year approaches and the so-called ship of state goes over the so-called fiscal cliff. There is, of course, a cynical interpretation of what the Tea Party caucus in the Congress are about, since they're the ones that held up the so-called Plan B that Speaker Boehner offered a few days ago and humiliated him. There's a notion that maybe they want to go over the fiscal cliff. That way, the tax rates will then go back up. And then instead of talking about increasing taxes, they'll be able to argue that they're actually talking about decreasing taxes. Is there anything to that?
I think that's true for some members. Yeah, I think that is right. But a lot of this is just sort of, dead enders. They basically refuse to vote to increase taxes. So it's a symbol. It's symbolism. And so my guess is that if they go past, technically the taxes go back up on January 1. And then the automatic cuts kick in on January 2nd. The new Congress convenes January 3rd. So that if they go past tomorrow evening, New Year's Eve, without passing something, then my guess is they'll pass something fairly quickly in the first week of January. That will be something like the $400,000 top rate is my guess.
So this is being in many ways cast as a battle between the Tea Party people who are influenced by Grover Norquist's pledge, and he's this obscure fellow that seems to have inordinate influence over the Congress, but largely because he can back up his threats and run people against the wavering Congress people in primaries, because he's supported, Grover Norquist is supported by some big money. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Again, we get down to the question of how much we're talking about ideology and how much we're talking about political patronage. And I'm curious to know whether there is a recognition there that this is really about the people who back Grover Norquist, as opposed to Grover Norquist himself. They've attributed great powers to him. What's your reading on that whole?
Well, this is the great irony. Norquist signed off on Boehner's bill because the bill was written, this is the $1 million top rate, the bill was written in such a way that your net, if you had that family income of $1 million or more, your net was going to be lower or unchanged. And he signed off on it, so that where it went off the rails was the Club for Growth and the Heritage Society. People threatened to run people in primaries against those members who would vote for Boehner's bill. The irony here is that rich people are split, because a lot of rich people, for example, in New York and Los Angeles and the big urban areas, are social liberals, and so they tend to back the Democrats. And so it's not just a monolithic kind of thing. And ditto big business, which is also split, and some big businesses back Democrats, some back Republicans. Where you see the real difference is small business, which tends to be overwhelmingly Republican. So that, what was key here is these outfits like the Club for Growth threatening to primary people. And that's the reason why it'll be much easier for them to vote after the first of the year on this kind of on a bill than it is now. But we're by no means, it's going to get even worse as we get into the later part of January.
And that's because, I take it, Keith Poole, that the debt limit comes up again. And the debt limit, it's the last time the debt limit was used, and it was actually used for the first time, to my knowledge, as a weapon, which, of course, brought about an increase in the cost of debt to the U.S. government. So it's a self-inflicted wound, because if you go to the mat and put up for ransom the full faith and credit of the United States government in terms of your political leverage, you end up making our debt more expensive, which is exactly the opposite of what you're proclaiming to be as a deficit hawk, surely.
Right, but the problem we've got is that we're running deficits on the order of about $1 trillion a year, and the reason why we're able to do that is that essentially we have 0% interest. I mean, all the experts agree that we have to do something about the rate of growth, especially of Medicare. Social Security is a relatively easy fix. The president has already agreed to use the chained CPI, which is the right adjustment to make, and that would fix Social Security, would be an easy fix. The big problem here is Medicare, which is growing exponentially. And because of the demographic shift in the United States, my generation, I was born in 1947, is starting to retire. And we're simply, most of this unless we can get economic growth back up to rates of around 4%, there's just simply no way that we can sustain this level of spending for many more years.
But how much is there realism? I mean, I wish that we were having a realistic debate instead of this kind of kabuki theater that's going on, because it's obvious that we need to increase revenues and that everybody should pay a little more in tax. And now, you can make the argument that we shouldn't do this right away because the economy is still recovering, and that austerity is the worst thing you can possibly do in terms of extinguishing a recovery. But there's this element that we talked about a little while ago, Keith Poole, of the Grover Norquist business. I mean, he's famous for saying he wants to shrink government down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. So is that, how much of this is just ideology? Again, I get back to this division between ideology and money. I recall in the presidential primary on the Republican side, all the candidates were asked a simple question, you know, would you agree to $9 in spending cuts for $1 increase in revenues? And none of them agreed to it. I mean, it's like, do these people understand mathematics?
Well, it's all ideological. I mean, it's ideology. In the primaries because you have to appeal to the a very small slice of the electorate that actually participates in primaries, you end up being forced to take these rather extreme positions, and it is all ideological. The thing is that there's no way that these entitlements can be cut very drastically for the very simple reason that people love them, and the main beneficiaries are middle-class Americans. Right now, a person retiring, say if I was able to retire, even though I've been working basically since 1965, if I lived my expected lifespan, the current estimate is you get out triple in real dollars you paid in. And that's the source of our problems, is that we've made these promises and we haven't funded, we haven't put aside the money to pay for them. One of the biggest frauds that has been perpetrated on the American public is that the politicians long ago spent all the surpluses. There are no trust funds. Those are a fiction. They exist only in the sense of a bookkeeping entry, and you can find it online. Non-negotiable, non-tradable securities. And if it's a non-negotiable, non-tradable security, it isn't real. So that politicians and both political parties over the last 30 years have spent everything that came in. That means that we have to pay for Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid out of current tax revenue. There are no savings. This means that the crisis is only going to continue to get worse and worse and worse with every passing year. And the two political parties are so severely polarized, it's going to be extremely difficult to come to a resolution of this because of this standoff in the electorate, where the Republicans control the House and probably will control the House until the next census. And the Democrats seem to have the edge in winning the presidency. So we're in real trouble.
Right, but Keith Poole, aren't we in trouble also because one party doesn't want to raise revenues and pay for the money that's already been raided? The other one does, and people have paid in. It's immoral to steal from the American people who are expecting something they paid for. Why not get some? I know the revenues that you get from taxing the wealthy are not going to close the gap
but it's a place to start, and maybe corporate taxes as well, or at least how much money they're hiding offshore. I mean, there are ways to go after the money without having to go after just Social Security, and you would think that Obama's signature Medicare Affordable Care Act would have done something about the out of control medical costs, but apparently not.
No, I think, look, there's no question that you can get more money. I mean, after all, it'd probably be a good thing just to let the Bush tax cuts completely expire, because that they did is they took so many people off the tax rolls that it's really caused a huge shortfall. So yes, you can get more money, but the difficulty is that the amount of money we're going to need to pay for Medicare, for example, is so staggering that you would have to raise taxes across the board on all the way down to, like, adjusted gross income of at least 25 or 30. You have to raise all those taxes substantially in order to get the cash. And I don't know whether or not, you know, the problem is that you got to have more revenue, and you've got to means test these entitlements. And so far, the political will is not there to do this.
Right.
One side doesn't want to raise revenue, and the other side doesn't want to cut benefits.
Right. And the
standoff.
And just in closing, then, Keith Poole, the one solution, which wasn't even on the table during the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare debate, was the idea of single-payer, a health system which the rest of the developed world has, and they pay about 6 to 8% of GDP on health care and have much better results, and we're up to about 18% of GDP, and it's growing on health care. So there's a solution staring us in the face, but not one that has snowball's chance in hell of ever getting even on the table.
No. Yeah. I don't think you'll ever see single payer here.
Right.
If anything, what'll happen is you will see a two-tier system emerge very quickly in the United States. This is the concierge system.
Right.
Because you cannot, under our laws, you cannot stop people from purchasing something like health services. So you'll see very quickly a two-tier system emerge, and it'll be a big mess.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Keith.
You bet. All right.
Again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who is the distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, and Of Congress, A Political Economic History of Roll Call Voting. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill.
A young cowboy named Billy Joe grew restless on the farm. A boy filled with wanderlust who really meant no harm. He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down. And his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. William Vizard, who's a professor emeritus and chair in the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and Shots in the Dark, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, as well as numerous articles on gun control, justice policy, policing, and investigation. Dr. Vizard served 30 years in law enforcement with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department and as a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. William Vizard.
Thank you.
And the New York Times carried a piece last week on how much the NRA at the behest, or the Congress at the behest of the NRA have hobbled the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives from doing their job. What, of course, I think indicates the hostility that the Congress has, at the behest of the NRA, towards the BATF is that the Bureau has not had a permanent director for 6 years. So the evidence is pretty manifest, isn't it?
It's manifest. But it's been a situation that has existed since the early 70s. It's just exacerbated over the years and intensified.
Well, I've spoken to Gerald Nunziato before, who created the firearms tracing, has headed up that at ATF. And he pointed out to me some time back that the Tiahrt Amendment that was passed more recently, of course, there's another bill that was passed back in '68 that's also hampered the agency's ability. But he pointed out that guns used in crimes are not traced. We think they are because everybody watches those TV shows like CSI, where you start out with a dead white girl in an alley, and the first thing they do is get a hit on the gun. Well, it doesn't happen in the real world, and the reason it doesn't happen, as far as I can tell, is because of the NRA.
Well, it doesn't happen because there's never been a national database. Now, the exception is California, where all retail sales are recorded and in a database. But that's not true of most states, and it's certainly not true nationally. The only way to trace a firearm is to go to ATF, who in turn goes to the manufacturer or importer, contacts them. They have a record of whom they've distributed the firearm to, which is a distributor, because all firearms go through distributors. And then from there out to the retail seller, or maybe sometimes through several, who can, assuming they're properly keeping their records, can identify the ultimate purchaser. Now, the firearm still may have gone through a number of hands after that first retail purchaser, but that's the only way to trace a firearm. Some are traceable, some are not.
But along with the fact that the ATF doesn't have a director, the Firearms Owners Protection Act of 1986 prohibits ATF agents from making more than one unannounced inspection per year of licensed gun dealers. Now, isn't it very clear that a vast percentage of guns used in crimes recovered at the scene or used in evidence in crimes are usually purchased from a very small number of gun dealers?
Well, to a large extent, that's true, but of course that's because a relatively small percentage of gun dealers account for most of the gun sales. So sometimes a lot of sales that are traced back to a dealer indicate that the dealer is questionable. Sometimes it just simply indicates that that's a dealer who sells more guns than anybody else. But the Firearms Owners Protection Act did far more damage than simply limiting inspections. The other things don't get much attention, but the reduction of false records keeping or failure to keep records to a misdemeanor means, for all practical purposes, no matter how egregious the false records keeping is, it can't be prosecuted because U.S. attorneys simply don't file misdemeanors. Secondly, it created a definition of engaging in the business, which makes it virtually impossible. Almost impossible, not quite, to charge individuals with selling guns without a license. and not keeping any records. And those two things actually did more damage even than the inspection restrictions. But they're harder to explain as to why, and so most people don't pay much attention to them.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. William Bazard, a professor emeritus and chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. And we know that enormous amounts of guns end up in Mexico, who've had 60 to 100,000 people have died of gun violence in the so-called war on drugs down there. And a lot of the arms, according to Mexican authorities, several Mexican presidents have complained about this, that they come from dealerships on the border. Because of what you just explained to us, little wonder that they can sell, 50 or 100 Bushmasters, like the one that was used to kill all those kids in Connecticut recently. And then, somebody can come back, a straw purchaser can come back and buy another 100 an hour later. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it?
That is the reality in virtually all states. A couple of states have passed one gun per month restrictions. And, of course, states like California, which track sales, it's a little easier to detect. But in general, what you say is true. In most states, you can walk in and buy as many over the counter and walk out with them immediately, as long as you don't have a criminal record. And although the NRA made a lot out of the Fast and Furious operation, which had its mistakes, those guns again were purchased over the counter on their surface lawfully, although probably not lawfully because there was a conspiracy to export them. But the number of guns in those transactions pales in comparison to the number of guns that have been going to Mexico over the years. Smuggling to Mexico was a problem back in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and it's just exacerbated over the years as the Mexican drug cartels have grown.
So, but when you combine, William Bazard, you combine the 1968 the 1986 Firearms Owner Protection Act and how much that hobbled the ATF, and then the Tiahrt Amendment, both in 2003, 2004, and up, and it was just recently adopted in 2010. That prevents the ATF from sharing gun crime data with any other law enforcement agencies. So if you look at all this, I think just fairly and reasonably, it all seems so counterintuitive, at least to me. You come to the conclusion that the central mantra of the NRA, which is that we're protecting law-abiding citizens' rights to own firearms, is nonsense. They're protecting criminals. I mean, is there
what they're doing is protecting their own existence. I mean, the fundamental function of the NRA is to keep the NRA. And in that, they don't differ much from other organizations, be they charitable or governmental or private industry. I mean, the NRA has turned into a rather profitable operation for the people who work there. And what they're doing works. And not that they don't ideologically agree. I mean, I don't think they're going against their own ideology. It happens to coincide with their self-interest.
Well, but they're funded by the firearms and ammunition factors.
To some extent, but it's a mistake to view them as an economic lobby in the sense that the oil lobby or the coal lobby is. They're an ideological lobby. The firearms business is small potatoes in the United States compared to really big industries. So, and that's the reason they're different. If you look at economic lobbies, they want to do things behind the scenes, quietly, that are economically viable for themselves. The NRA wants to constantly generate controversy because that's what keeps their members loyal, scared, and active. So they don't behave like commercial lobbies behave. They're more like the lobbies on both sides of the abortion issue, let's say, or other ideological lobbies.
Right, but the irony is that
just given what you've just told us, Dr. William Vassard, is that when you have incidents like this horrible tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, where young schoolchildren are slaughtered, that ends up, look at the facts, look at the results of what's happened since then. As much as people in this country have been appalled by it, and around the world they're just scratching their heads, nevertheless, the NRA is they claim that they've got 800,000 new members, and assault rifles are flying off the shelves. I believe in the last few weeks there have been record gun sales in America.
The more controversy there is, the better off the NRA is. Every time one of these issues, whether it's a real controversy or a manufactured one, they benefit. They win both ways. And but even more fundamental than the role of the NRA, frankly, if you look at ATF and its function, is Congress has never actually decided what it wants ATF's role to be. I mean, the Gun Control Act of 68 was a weak law, greatly weakened by the 86 Firearms Owners Protection Act. And they're really, ATF does some excellent work on individual felons, violent offenders, bombings, arsons. But when it comes to controlling commerce, it really doesn't have a mandate as to what it's supposed to be doing. And what little mandate it had in 68 was actually subsequently weakened in 86. So it's really, in many ways, an agency adrift with no political support whatsoever. I mean, as you cite, they haven't had a director in 6 years. And before that, frankly, most of the directors, with, I would say, one exception, were relatively weak. It just doesn't have support in Congress, and most administrations are just not willing to fight the battle they'd have to fight, because it's gun control is like their fifth most important issue. And one can understand that when you deal with war and peace and the economy and all the other things an administration has to deal with. They're simply not willing to use political capital to push gun control, particularly when they can count and realize that they haven't gotten much success with it.
And this is in spite of the fact that the majority of Americans want something to be done. So,
well, they do, but they want something in the abstract. But when you start pushing them on specifics, they're not that committed. I mean, again, they have kind of a fuzzy sense that they'd like something to happen.
Right.
But they aren't deeply committed, and there's no lobby supporting gun control. There's no money to be made in it. There's no advantage to it.
Right.
So, you know, the surveys, frankly, used to show much stronger support for gun control in the 70s and the 80s than they do now.
Well, Dr. William,
the NRA has largely dominated the narrative for the last 25 or 30 years.
Well, Dr. William Vassard, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're most welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. William Vassard. He's Professor Emeritus and Chair of the Division of Criminal Justice at California State University, Sacramento. He's the author of Shots in the Dark, Policy, Politics, and Symbolism of Gun Control, and Shots in the Dark, A Political History of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll back and go to Amman, Jordan, for a possible breakthrough in the Arab-Israeli long, painful saga. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Amman, Jordan, is Dawood Khatab, who is a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. Khatab is a Palestinian journalist and media activist who was born in Jerusalem and studied in the United States. In 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, AmanNet. He's an award-winning journalist and TV producer and is active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East. And he has an article at The Atlantic
Are Palestinians ready to share a state with Jordan? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dawad Khatib.
Yes, thank you.
So tell me, in your article in The Atlantic, Are Palestinians Ready to Share a State with Jordan? You cite the prince, the brother of the former king, Prince Hassan, mentioning the possibility, and some other sources. Of course, one of the ironies of this is, hasn't it always been a kind of the Likud right-wing dream in Israel to somehow for the Palestinians to go away and form a state in Jordan?
Well, I didn't make the headline, as you know. I argued that there is a change in the political atmosphere now that the UN recognized with an overwhelming majority the state of Palestine on the 67 borders. And what I argued based on what is happening is that there is a possibility for Palestinians and Israel and Jordanians to reconsider the idea of a confederation, not the federation. And the confederation is defined as a union of two independent states. So we're not talking here about the transfer people or setting up a Palestinian state in Jordan or any of that Likud stuff. We're talking here about the potential after there is an independent Palestinian state that there will be a confederate agreement with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan.
Well, of course, going back to 67, there was a great deal of reluctance on both the King Hussein side in Jordan and on the part of the Israelis in that war, the 67 war, to go to war. And essentially, Jordan was forced into it, was it not, by Syria and Egypt. So the situation prior to 67 seemed to be at least work for both sides. Am I correct?
Well, there is a lot of confusion about the situation. And again, even as late as this year, an Israeli commission tried to justify the existence of Jewish settlements in the West Bank by saying that the West Bank is disputed territory, is not occupied territory, because at the time before 67, only two countries recognized Jordan's annexation of the West Bank. But what I am trying to say is that after the UN, with 139 countries, approved the state of Palestine, this issue is no longer valid, and no longer people can worry about the idea whether the West Bank is disputed or not, or who was controlling what before 67 and who recognized what before 67. There is clear evidence now by the overwhelming majority of the world countries, including most of the Security Council permanent members, with the exception, unfortunately, of the U.S., that Palestine is the state for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and that this allows for the Palestinians, if they choose, to confederate or to make some kind of an arrangement with their nearest Arab neighbor, which is Jordan.
Well, I think in many ways, Dawad Khatib, what is attractive about this possibility is that the status quo is getting worse for both Palestine and for Jordan, is it not? There have been indications inside of Jordan itself, demonstrations over the cutting of subsidies for gasoline, etc. Jordan is swamped by refugees from the ill-considered and disastrous American war in Iraq. And also now with the civil war going on in Syria, and on the Palestinian side, the PLO, or the Palestinian Authority, has all but been castrated by both the Israelis continually pressuring them and frustrating them and not being serious about peace. Well, they're serious about peace talks, but not about peace. And then Hamas seems to be gaining more and more credibility within the Palestinian community. So this sounds to me, given the current trajectory, a very hopeful reversal of what looks like more and more bad news.
Yeah, I mean, around the world today, a country, especially small countries, are realizing that you cannot live as a small economic island, that you need to have open markets with your neighbors and so on. So from an economic point of view, the integration of Jordan and Palestine, in fact, Palestine with the Arab world, the opening up of the markets of the Arab world to each other, will be economically beneficial. The problem has always been that, as you said in your outset, that some in Israel, some of the right-wing Israelis, will jump on this idea as to say, there's no need to give Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza. They can go set up a state in Jordan. And this has always been the reason why, at one time, the late King Hussein said, don't even talk anymore about confederation, because Israelis were basically saying, you know, Jordan here, take care of the Palestinians, and we don't want to worry about them. So what happened in the last few months is that when the PLO, when the UN recognized the state of Palestine on the 67 border, this worry, which the late King Hussein had worried about, is no longer there. And anyway, relations between Palestinian leadership under Abbas and the new King Abdullah are much less cautious than they were between Arafat and King Hussein, where there was a lot of rivalry and worry about what the Jordanians really want and whether there is some kind of conspiracy. So some of these worries are no longer there. And from an economic point of view, any deal that opens up more markets and allows people to move goods and people from one country to another are usually good for the economic point of view.
Again, I'm speaking with Daoud Kutab, who is in Amman, Jordan. He's a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. And he's a Palestinian journalist and media activist, born in Jerusalem, studied in the United States. And in 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, AmanNet. He's an award-winning journalist and TV producer, and is active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East, and has an article at The Atlantic, "Are Palestinians Ready to Share a State with Jordan?" Well, I don't expect necessarily rationality from the Israeli right, and they seem to be dominating politics in Israel more and more, and probably will continue to do so. The influx of Russian refugees from the Soviet Union has turned the country to the right, and the diaspora, particularly the wealthy diaspora here in the United States, has always pushed them to the right. A lot of the West Bank settlements are financed by American billionaires who push a very right-wing agenda, even though the majority of American Jews are very liberal. So it is seems to me that throughout the 60s and 70s, the Israelis always said that they were surrounded by people who wanted to kill them. And that was always hyperbole, given Israel's military strength. But now you could make the case that Israel's security is, in fact, getting worse and worse. If they end up with a Muslim Brotherhood government in Syria, which seems to be inevitable, the new Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt is less than friendly, and the entire Sinai area has become porous and lawless, and King Hussein's situation is not strong in Jordan. So you would think at some point the Israelis would want to come to their senses about getting serious about dealing with the Palestinians instead of trying to sort of confiscate their land and punish them indefinitely with this kind of apartheid policy that they seem to have.
Yes, I mean, it is true that we've been stuck in a kind of a cycle. And what is interesting about this suggestion, I'm not sure it will actually work. Jordanians themselves, East Bank Jordanians, are not very excited about it. Many Palestinians are worried about it. But what is interesting about it is it changes somehow the rules of the game. It provides many Israelis who are genuinely worried and fearful a kind of a way out, because the Israelis have a very high degree of confidence in Jordanians and the King Abdullah. So if there is interest, if there is a will for peace, I think this provides people with goodwill with an opportunity to get involved in the peace process. Again, it's a long shot, and you know, it's doubtful that it will work. But if there is goodwill, I think this could be an opportunity for creative diplomacy. Obama is in his second term with less worries about being reelected and more about his legacy. So there are things that are there that can make this a possibility, but again, there are so many things that can go wrong.
Well, Daoud Kitab, who is talking about it, apart from the brother of the late king, Prince Hassan, and others that you've cited in your article in The Atlantic? You also indicate that some U.S. diplomats have been talking about this behind the scenes. So how much
The former head of the PLO's political committee, Farouk Al-Kaddoum, has spoken about it. And the one newspaper in London, an Arabic newspaper, is quoted senior officials in the PLO as being told by President Abbas to kind of prepare for the possibility of some kind of confederation. We know that King Abdullah made a surprise visit about 2 weeks ago to Ramallah right after the UN vote, and he became the first Arab leader to visit Ramallah. So there are different signs here and there. It's, you know, as in the Middle East, you have to really be very careful because if an idea becomes too public, it actually can destroy it. So I think they're trying to play careful politics on this issue and with the hope that if they can get enough support, then, you know, then it might become more public if they can somehow find ways to get different parts of this idea resolved and some of the difficulties like Jerusalem and settlement and the borders and all that. So, again, you know, God is in the details, and there are so many details that can easily go wrong. And I think that's why you will not hear any major public support for it.
Well, but your basic point, Daoud Kitab, that this is the only thing that makes sense economically in the new economic world order of globalism, etc., that small countries can't survive, and
absolutely.
And the West and the Palestinian
the West Bank will not be very viable unless they have open borders with their natural relations with the other Arab countries, where they can trade, where they speak the same language, have the same culture. So it's only normal to think in this direction, and
would this give Jordan a corridor to the Mediterranean? Could this be worked out? Because Jordan is not
a give Jordan a number of economic benefits vis-a-vis the market in Palestine, using the high level of educated Palestinians in the West Bank. It can also, there are possibilities, but this is not the real problem. The real problem is to take care of the politics. In the Middle East, the politics trumps everything. And if we can find people with goodwill, with creativity, to try to kind of cross the T's and dot the I's and deal with the politics, I think the economics would easily benefit. But we have to take care of the politics first.
But surely any rational person can see that the politics are going nowhere. They're going from bad to worse.
True, absolutely. And because we've been dealing with the same rationale, with the same obstacles, the Palestinians will not negotiate until the Israelis stop the settlement. Israelis says, you're not negotiating, therefore you're not interested in peace. Palestinians say the Israelis just want photo opportunities, and they don't want to negotiate. They've been negotiating for 20 years, while at the same time building settlements in where the Palestinian state will be. So it's an endless rhetorical cycle that's not going to be broken until there is somehow a game changer. And people are now cautiously optimistic that maybe in the next year, with Mahmoud Abbas saying he's not going to run for elections anymore, Obama is not going to run for elections anymore, there are certain things that can happen if people really want it to happen.
And of course, as you say, the recent declaration of statehood in the United Nations by and the acceptance by the United Nations of Palestine is a game changer. But surely a new regime in Syria would be also a game changer in terms of diminishing Iran's influence, particularly via Hezbollah. So the region's in flux. I mean, I suggested that things were getting worse for the Israelis, but in a way, if they could seize this initiative, maybe things could get better for them.
You can look at it in different ways. You could say that, you know, the Nixon to China syndrome can work if Netanyahu is reelected, and he now would be reelected for three times. He might want to also think about his own legacy. If you want to look in a positive half-full cup, you can find it. And if you want to see the half-empty cup, you can also find it. We've been talking about this issue and suffering because of the continuation of occupation for four decades now. And we just need somehow people that can really take courage and follow through with their own words and have some action on the ground to end this occupation. We believe it's the cause of poisoning the atmosphere in many other conflicts in the region.
Well, Dawood Qutob, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dawood Qutob, who is in Amman, Jordan. He is a former Ferris Professor of Journalism at Princeton University, where he taught a seminar on new media in the Arab world. He's a Palestinian journalist and media activist who was born in Jerusalem and studied in the United States. And in 2000, he established the Arab world's first internet radio station, Amman Net. And he's an award-winning journalist and TV producer, active in media freedom efforts in the Middle East. And he has an article in The Atlantic, Are Palestinians Ready to Share a State with Jordan?
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers G and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.